Okay, so I think we should probably start the talk. So the theme of this talk, or the way it is described in the newsletter and everywhere else, is the Buddha's message of happiness. I'm going to talk about this in a few different ways. And of course, because essentially the Buddha's teaching is a way to find happiness in the world, a way to get out of suffering. This is kind of the core thing of the Buddha's message. And of course, on a Vaisak day like this, this is especially a celebration of the Buddha himself, because it is about the Buddha being born, enlightened, and passing away on this day. That's just a traditional date, but that is what we're celebrating today. And the first thing that I would like to say about this person who was the Buddha, and which for me is a very simple thing here, but in many ways also very inspiring for people who want to practice in accordance with his teachings, and that is to remember that the Buddha, he was a person just like all of us. And because he was a person just like all of us, he wasn't a god, he wasn't something absolutely different from us. It means that because the Buddha was able to practice in this way, he was able to attain enlightenment, he was able to do these things. Because we are essentially the same as the Buddha, it means that we can also do it. We can follow in the footsteps of the Buddha, and we can take the Buddha as our ideal, as our standard, and we can do things in the same way that he did. So that is the first thing to understand. Even though he obviously was very wise, even though he had special qualities, essentially he was a human being just like the rest of us. And I find that so inspiring that we have a teaching where we're not worshipping something which is completely other, but we're worshipping kind of the highest potential in all of us, the possibility of reaching something beautiful in our lives, of reaching enlightenment, if you like. So this is the starting point. But of course, when we talk about the Buddha, we also talk about the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the teaching of the Buddha. Because essentially, the Buddha and the Dhamma are not two separate things. These are two sides of the same coin. And if you read what the Buddha said, the Buddha said that if you understand the Buddha, you also understand the Dhamma. If you know the Dhamma, you also know the Buddha. These two things are inseparable. You cannot say that the Buddha is one thing, the Dhamma is one thing. In one sense you can, but ultimately they are very, very closely related. And the reason for that, of course, is because the Buddha, first of all, he is the highest expression of that Dhamma. He has practiced it to the full end. He has realized the highest possible kind of happiness and peace and contentment. He embodies in his person the qualities that we're all striving to attain as Buddhists. That is the first reason. He is this Dhamma in the sense that he is these qualities. And the second reason that the Buddha is the Dhamma is because the only purpose of the Buddha's life after his full enlightenment is to teach the Dhamma. This is all that he's about, teaching the Dhamma. For him, it's the only thing in the world which makes any sense anymore, is teaching the Dhamma, and of course living in accordance with it, because that is what he is. In that sense, he is also the Dhamma. There's no difference between the two. He is only interested in the Dhamma. Everything else has become completely insignificant as far as the Buddha is concerned. So in this way, when we reflect on the Buddha today, when we celebrate his achievements and his birth and also his death, in a sense, we are also celebrating the Dhamma, because there isn't really any distinction here. Now, this Dhamma that we are celebrating, of course, the most important of these teachings, for those of you who have been Buddhists a long time, you know that the essence of the Dhamma can be taught in the Four Noble Truths. And again, briefly, for those of you not aware of this, the Four Noble Truths are the truths of suffering, that there is suffering in the world. The second one is the cause of suffering, that there is a reason why suffering arises. The third one is that there is an end to that suffering if we take away the cause. If there's a cause, remove the cause, suffering must end as a consequence. And the last one is the path, that there is a path to the end of suffering. In other words, Buddhism is one of these beautiful things. It gives you a teaching which is practical, something you can do to overcome the troubles of life. And sometimes people say, well, this is a bit negative because it's all focused on suffering. And there is maybe, and it can maybe be regarded in such a way, but if you also reflect that it teaches you the path to the end of suffering, it's also a very hopeful teaching. But in any way, there is an alternative way of looking at this teaching, which I was taught many, many years ago by Ajahn Brahma, and it sort of piqued my interest when I heard this, because it made sense to me. And he said something like this, well, this is my own words, after a while you sort of change things a little bit, because you think of these things yourself. But essentially what he said was that, well, if you understand suffering in the world, you also understand happiness. Because suffering and happiness are two sides of the same coin. If you understand where suffering is, you also understand where happiness is. These always must go together. The second noble truth is about the cause of suffering. Well, if you know the cause of suffering, you also know the cause why happiness is getting less, why happiness is getting diminished. If something is the cause for suffering, it's also the cause for having less happiness. If you know the truth of the end of suffering, that is equivalent to the truth of happiness, because the end of suffering must be the happiness. And the path to the end of suffering is, of course, the path to happiness. These are always two sides of the same coin. You cannot separate these things. And this is a very useful way of understanding the Buddha's teachings, because we're all searching for happiness in our lives. We don't want to get depressed and down and negative and all these kind of things. It just feels painful. So because we are searching for this here, we have the answer to what we're all striving to get in our lives. In a sense, you could say that the Buddha's teaching is the answer to the meaning of life, because this is what we all aspire to. This is what we all want to have. Find contentment. Find some kind of true and lasting fulfillment and satisfaction. So that is just to give you a kind of framework that the Buddha's teaching is essentially about happiness, and to explain you why that is the case. Before I explain in more detail about the search for happiness in human beings, I want to also reflect very briefly on the life of the Buddha, particularly the very end of his life, because this life of the Buddha, of course, we are here to celebrate the Buddha today, so it's good to reflect on that life. But also it shows us how happiness, what happiness actually is, and how it comes to be. Because his life is an expression of that. His own search gives us an idea of how to understand happiness in this world. And as you probably know already, the Buddha, of course, grew up in very nice. I talked about this yesterday. I'm going to repeat myself, but I find it such an inspiring story that I'd like to repeat this endlessly here. So I hope you forgive me for that. So he lived a very protected life when he was young. He had all the good things in life that anybody can aspire for, the best clothes, the good food, the large, many homes that he had. He was living now here, now there. And he lived in a very high class in India at the time. The Indian society has always been very structured in castes. And if you're at the top of society, you are very high up in Indian society. And he was, of course, praised because he was loved by his parents and all these things. He had everything that anybody can really want in this world. And yet, he decided that there is a problem here. I've got everything you can possibly desire in this world. And yet, there is a problem. Well, what is that problem? He looked around him. He saw people are still suffering. He saw people are getting old. He saw people dying. And he saw people getting born in the world. And he realized that I, too, I'm subject to these things. How can I just run around being heedless, enjoying myself, when I know that one day I'm going to have to pay the price for that heedlessness? One day I'm going to die. And that day, when I have attached myself to all these beloved things of mine, whether it's property, whether it's wife, whether it's children, whatever it is, then I'm going to suffer because of that attachment which arises. So he understood the suffering in the world, which is there, no matter how good your life is, there is always going to be a problem there. And you will have noticed that one of the things that the Buddha realized at this time was that there is birth in the future. In other words, he had this idea that he will be reborn and have to do these things again and again in the future. And then the Buddha goes off and he starts practicing, trying to find a solution to this problem. He becomes a monk. He leaves the household life. And he starts practicing under various teachers. And he tries the methods of meditation that are available at the time of the Buddha. Then he tries the other kind of practice, which is like ascetic practices, which also was one of the big things at the time of the Buddha. And he realizes none of these practices really lead anywhere. And then, having tried all those things, he sets out on his own to try to find the solution to his problem, the ending of all this suffering, the ending of birth, aging, and death. And then, of course, he does the very deep meditation, the kind of meditation which makes you so peaceful and so silent inside, and so blissful in many ways, that your mind becomes incredibly powerful. And when that mind is so incredibly powerful, only then have you got the opportunity to penetrate and understand what the solution actually is, what the problem actually is. After having done that deep meditation, he turns that powerful mind and try to recall what happened before I was born. What happened? Is it possible to go back beyond my own birth? And then by even recollecting that powerful mind before his own birth, he realizes that there was another life before that. And he sees his own death in the past life. And then goes back into that past life and goes backwards and backwards and backwards from life to life, seeing that there is this endless chain going backwards. You cannot really find the first point of life after life after life. So this was the first realization that the Buddha had on his night of enlightenment. He realized that there is this chain of births going backwards and backwards. And of course, that he understood is a big, big problem. Because you have the suffering in this life is only in this life. But in fact, it goes back endlessly. There's no end to these problems. Then, as the night went on, after having understood rebirth, he also came to understand the laws of karma, because the laws of karma are, in a sense, the things that guide rebirth in life. You understand karma, you understand how rebirth comes about. And then, having then understood the laws of karma and rebirth, then, because he saw the danger and the terrible thing, really, which is rebirth going around and again, then he was able to make his penetration to full enlightenment, to give up this entire thing called rebirth. And that, then, is the highest happiness, to end this thing that we call rebirth. But, of course, there's much more to this idea of happiness in Buddhism and ending rebirth. And the rest of my talk is going to be more about that. But before I want to talk, before I'm talking about the more direct aspects of suffering and happiness in life, I want to talk a little bit about who is this Buddha which now has become enlightened. Because this is, after all, a celebration of the Buddha himself. Who is this person? And the first thing that you will notice about this person is that he has understood the highest form of happiness in the world. He has seen the end of suffering. And when you realize that everybody in the world wants to be happy, everybody wants to be free of suffering, we all want to be content, we all want to be at peace, we all want to be free of stress and all these troubles, then you realize that he has become the wisest person that anybody can possibly be, because he has found the answer to what we all are ultimately seeking for, an end of this problem, an end, a movement towards a final fulfillment in life, a sense of absolute and ultimate contentment, the highest possible happiness. Of course, if you have found the solution to what everybody really desires at the end of the day, then you are the wisest possible that anybody can possibly be. Reflect on that. Isn't it wonderful that the teacher, our teacher, is the wisest possible that any human being can ever become? This is your teacher, the wisest person in existence as far as Buddhists are concerned. And I, as far as I'm concerned, anybody in existence anywhere. Of course, that's one aspect of the Buddha. The other aspect of the Buddha, which is so beautiful and I like to reflect on, is that when once he understood that he had found the solution to everybody's problems, he knew that he had found what everybody is searching for, and then he looks out into the world and he sees people out there struggling to find true happiness in their lives, struggling to get away from the problems, people blinded because they cannot see properly where the truth lies. And because they cannot see properly where the truth lies, they do things which are opposite to what they should be doing to actually gain that happiness. So people are blind, they are fumbling around in the darkness, just like the Buddha himself was before his enlightenment. And of course, when you see that you have the solution to the problem, and you realize that all these beings out there crying out for that solution, one thing to see, one thing to understand, what happens? What happens? Compassion arises in you. And this, then, is the second important aspect of the Buddha. He, in a sense, embodies compassion, because his motivation for his last 45 years of his life is only that, to teach other people, to make them understand the teaching that he has realized for himself. So that is what the Buddha's life is all about. There's nothing else for the Buddha apart from teaching others at this particular point. So he is compassion. That is pretty much what this person is. So reflect on this for a second. Here, the Buddha ultimately is all our teacher. He's my teacher. He's anybody who's a Buddhist, he's their teacher. And what you have, this teacher is a person who is the wisest person that can possibly exist. And he is also the most compassionate person that can possibly exist. He combines these two beautiful qualities of wisdom and compassion. And this is our teacher. And you might think, well, he's not really my teacher because I have never met the Buddha. He lived 2,500 years ago. But you shouldn't think like that. Because the reality is that when the Buddha sat in front of people 2,500 years ago and he taught the Dhamma, he realized at that point that this Dhamma is going to keep on going, rolling on for a long, long time in the future. And when he gave his teachings, he gave it in such a way, in a timeless language, in a way that speaks to us directly here and now after 2,500 years. And that is the powerful thing of the Buddha's message. If you read what he said, it doesn't really sound like it's 2,500 years old. It sounds like it could have been said by anybody today because it makes sense. It's something which strikes you as very, very direct and very beautiful. So because the Buddha knew, essentially, that we would be sitting here today 2,500 years later, and he phrased his teaching in such a way that we could also understand it, then he becomes directly our teacher. Because he knew about this. He knew that would be he'd be here today. He thought about us. All of us here today, he thought about us when he gave the teachings 2,500 years ago. And that is such a beautiful thought. Think about that. He actually, this man who is the wisest person in existence, the most compassionate one, he thought about us 2,500 years ago. He is your teacher very, very directly. It's a beautiful thing to think about. And when you think about that, it can give rise to a lot of happiness and joy. This is a kind of called the recollection of the Buddha, the recollection of the beautiful qualities of this person who lived 2,500 years ago. And I would urge you to think in this way because it gives you a sense of connection to the Buddha, gives a sense of connection to the Dhamma, which makes it a much more powerful teaching in your life. So that is just a little bit about the Buddha who we are celebrating today. And now I want to go back a little bit more about, well, what is it that actually the Buddha discovered on his enlightenment? How does that affect us? What is the connection between his discovery and our well-being here and now, our happiness and suffering here and now? And what the Buddha discovered, the first thing that he saw, obviously, and this is something we can all see in ourselves if we look inside of us, is that as beings, as human beings, it also includes animals, it includes any beings which exist anywhere, we have feelings. Feelings is an essential part of human life. You cannot live and exist without having feelings. And once you have feelings, there is essentially two types of feelings. There is positive feelings and there is negative feelings. And there are the feelings we don't want, the feelings that we do want. There are also many neutral feelings, but you can put those neutral feelings aside for now because they are really not so relevant. But essentially, if you are human, you're going to have feelings you like and you're going to have feelings you don't like. And this is what it means to be human, that we have this kind of duality in feelings. Now, once you have feelings you like and feelings you don't like, what happens then? What happens is that you get a desire for those feelings you like. You want to have more of those feelings. You try your best to somehow achieve those feelings most of your time, all of the time if you possibly can. And one, because you have negative feelings, you get the desire to get rid of these negative feelings. How can I overcome these problems? How can I overcome whatever pain and disappointment and problems I have in my life? And this is just, again, is the natural consequence of having feelings, that we want to overcome them. So because of that, desire and craving is an integral part of human life. It's something you cannot get away from, unless, of course, you're fully enlightened. We'll talk about that maybe a little bit later on. Now, once you have this craving, then we start doing all kinds of things. We start to scheme, we try to find ways of establishing ourselves in such a way that we can have good feelings all the time and avoid the bad feelings. We attach to things. We get a family. We buy ourselves a house. We get all sorts of possession. We go to do all kind of entertainment. We get ourselves. We try to maybe join a religion even. Why do people become Buddhists? I say, well, the reason I'm a Buddhist anyway is because I think it can give me some happiness in life. That's the only reason. And I say, the same thing is for everybody else. We're always searching for the good feelings in life. Everything we do is about taking up strategies to try to attain something positive in life, something good, something makes us feel well, makes us have some sort of well-being and avoid the pains and the problems. And just to go on a little bit more, once we take up all these kind of things, it is in a sense we establish ourselves, we establish our mind in that particular way of thinking. We exist according to how we live our life, how we strategize, what kind of strategies we use in our life. And because we exist in this particular way, this is then how rebirth comes to be in the future, because we establish our mind in a particular way of thinking, in a particular way of existing. So when the body passes away, there the mind is straight away in that particular way of thinking and existence. And that is how then rebirth can happen again in the future. But that is not really the point. The point I want to, let us just bring a little bit further, but the main point is that we all crave for things. We make strategies to achieve the fulfillment of that craving, whether it's ending suffering or it's giving rise to happiness. But the problem is that most people, even though they have this craving in their lives, they don't find that fulfillment that they want. They don't find that ending of craving, that final satisfaction and contentment that they desire. They can't find that. And if you think about it, this is, in a sense, the tragedy of existence. The tragedy is that we all run around trying to find satisfaction in our lives, trying to find contentment, and not being able to do it. And the reason why we can't do it is because we are looking for this in the wrong place. So what I was saying, for those of you who just come in, is that most people, when they search for happiness in life, because that's what we're all doing ultimately, we tend to search in the wrong place. And because we search in the wrong place, we don't really find that which we are seeking for. We crave for happiness, we crave for contentment and fulfillment, but we don't, very often don't find it. We're looking in the wrong place because we are looking outside ourselves for our happiness. And if you start looking outside of yourself, if you try to find fulfillment through material well-being, through being wealthy, through friends, through even through family, ultimately, it is always bound to be disappointing because it never really gives that sense of fulfillment that we want in life. It is something which is good for a while, and then that sense of well-being you have from material well-being, even family and friends, it tends to wear off, and still, the craving is still there, the desire is all there, it's still there. And we all know that in our lives. We seek something, we gain something, but as soon as it is gained, or soon afterwards, the craving comes back again, and we crave for something else. It's endless, it goes on and on and on. Externally, we are never going to find a final and ultimate satisfaction. And all you have to do is reflect a little bit on your own life, and you realize that this has to be true. This is the way it actually is. So, because by looking outside of ourselves, we cannot really find any true satisfaction and happiness, well, guess where you have to look? You have to look inside of yourself instead. And this looking inside ourselves basically means that we have to develop our sense of happiness by developing our mind. But by developing the mind, that you are developing happiness inside. And one of the things that I find so fascinating is that if you think about this, and it's pretty obvious that true happiness is to be found in the mind. If you look around to people, sometimes you hear about people who are very wealthy, very popular, very famous, they have everything in the world, and yet sometimes they are miserable. It's very obvious. Sometimes they end up being drug addicts and all kinds of things because, you know, look at some of these Hollywood stars or whatever. It looks like they've got everything, and yet they have nothing. They have nothing because they are miserable and they're not happy. And we know, all of us know of examples of people who are wealthy and apparently successful, and yet they are miserable. They have a bad life, a sad life. It doesn't work out. And of course, the reason is because the mind is much more important for your happiness than the external things, than the outer world. So what we have to do is we have to move towards the development of happiness inside the mind instead. So why is it, if it's so obvious that the mind is what matters, how come not everybody goes out there and says, yes, I will be a Buddhist, or I will be at least somebody who develops the mind? Why is that? And one reason, I think, is because people don't understand that it actually is possible to develop the mind in the first place. The understanding that you can develop the mind is something itself very profound and very unique. And this is, of course, therefore, a very important aspect of the Buddha's teachings, and one of the key foundation stones, that you can develop your mind. You can change your outlook. You can change the way you feel. You can change the way you see the world. All of these things are subject to change. And of course, the way we do this change, the way we change our mind, is by practicing doing the Buddhist practices that we all, probably most of you, are familiar with. The practices of virtue, morality, the practices of generosity, the practices of being kind and good in the world, of being compassionate, of having loving kindness for the people around us, of being peaceful, of doing meditation practice, being contented with what we have. All of these things, being wise as well, all of these things, these are the things which lead to greater happiness in our lives. And I think, just to give you an idea why that is, I think it's important to maybe reflect on why this is the case. It is actually quite simple if you think about it correctly. And I like to talk about things, why things are, because if you have a sense of why, if there's an understanding there, it's easier to put these things into practice. So why is it that these acts of goodness, of charity, of kindness, why is it that it leads to greater happiness? And why is it that the opposite, doing bad things, immoral things, leads to less happiness, and leads to less contentment and less satisfaction? And I just ask you to reflect on your own life. If you do something which really is bad, something which you realize afterwards you shouldn't have done, how do you feel about that? And I would say most people, of course, there are always somebody who are kind of exceptions to the rule, but most people would feel bad after done something bad. They don't feel good about themselves. It's a kind of remorse. It doesn't have to be remorse in the ordinary sense. It can just be like a slight darkening of the mind. The mind is not so bright anymore. You don't have the same sense of self-esteem. You don't feel so good about yourself. And that is the consequence. When we reflect on it, I think we will all see that this is what happens if we do something bad. And the problem is that if you continue doing bad things, if you do this again and again and again, you are dragging down your mind. It becomes a darker and darker place, less and less satisfactory, less and less peaceful. You have less and less, feel less and less good about yourself, less and less self-satisfaction and fulfillment in your life. And you're creating a place where it's very unpleasant to live. It's very difficult and unpleasant to live in a dark mind, which is not doesn't have any positive qualities in it. And of course, our mind is ultimately our real home. This is where we live. This is who we are. If we are anything, we are the mind. So you want to create a beautiful home for yourself. So then instead of doing bad deeds, instead of doing bad things, we do good things instead. And think about it in your life. I certainly know this from my own life. Sometimes you do something good. Maybe it's just a spontaneous act of something. How do you feel afterwards when you spontaneously do something nice? You often feel good about yourself. Feel a sense of joy, a sense of satisfaction. You've done something nice in the world. The mind brightens up. You get a sense of joy, a contentment, a fulfillment in your life. All these good things come to you because of that. And then when you keep doing good things for a long period of time, again and again and again, then gradually, stage by stage, you brighten up your mind. You become more happy, you become more fulfilled as a person, you become more peaceful, more tranquil, you become more compassionate, you become more kind to all beings around you. All these things come together. And that, of course, is why goodness, why practicing in the right way, why it gives definite results on the mind, because we're making the mind a beautiful place. And then, when your mind is beautiful, it is so nice to be at home inside yourself. You feel so good about yourself. You feel independent from the world outside. It doesn't matter so much. It's still going to be painful if the stock market crashes. It's still going to be painful if your wife or your husband leaves you, of course. But it's going to have much less impact on you because you have a sense of independence. Your source of happiness comes from inside of you, and the external happinesses are not so important for you anymore. And that sense of independence, of being free of the external world, at least to some extent, this is called freedom. This is called liberation in Buddhism. This is a very powerful sense of being your own person, of being independent in the world. And then you start to gain some mastery over yourself, and you start to gain this promise of happiness that the Buddha said we all can achieve as long as we just keep practicing in the right way, in the correct path. So, this is, in brief, this is at least part of the Buddha's message of happiness. It's about practicing the right thing. And on a day like today, reflect that these teachings that you're hearing now is essentially, I'm just basically trying to convey to you what the Buddha said 2,500 years ago. I'm trying to say what the Buddha said. This all really comes from the Buddha. And that is the beautiful thing on the Vesak day today, that the Dhamma that we hear, the teachings that we have, they go back to the Buddha. And remember that this Buddha was a wise and compassionate teacher. We can trust in him. These teachings are beautiful, and they lead in the right direction. The reason I say that they lead in the right direction, I've been a Buddhist monk now for, it's almost 15 years now, and I look at myself and I ask myself, who was I 15 years ago and who am I now? And it's an enormous change that has happened in terms of contentment and satisfaction in life, in terms of feeling good about myself, what I am now compared to 15 years ago. So for me, there is no doubt that this works. So I'm not just saying this because I have read it in the scriptures. I'm saying this because for me, this is the truth. This, as far as I can see, this path works and it leads in the right direction. It is a path of happiness and it leads to a sense of greater contentment in life. So, that is the Vesak talk. Yeah?